The first time I really heard the banjo in a significant way and was really attracted to it, it was when I was at this party in college. And I walked into the apartment and I heard this trance-like rippling sound coming out of the corner, and it ended up that it was an old record of Doc Watson playing Shady Grove. And I was just struck by the sound of that rippling banjo tone and quality and with this high lonesome vocal on top of it. And I just knew it was for me. I literally went out and bought a banjo and tried to learn Shady Grove on it right away. And I know that sound comes from Doc Watson, and it's deeply ingrained in North Carolina, the hills and mountains of North Carolina. I was lucky to get to go to Doc's funeral in Deep Gap just a year and a half ago. And I've been struck over and over again by how important North Carolina and the music there has been to me, but also to Bela. It's been a really, really significant place for both of us. It's kind of a surprise we don't live there, actually.
Well, come on. And no coincidence that the festival you'll be performing in, Crossroads, really, it is a crossroads in so many respects. I mean, including, I think, of jazz and so many other types of music and bluegrass and old-timey. There's an ease with which he, in particular that tune, his signature tune, comes across that you share as well in your performance, Abigail, that just makes it seem so easy. And I just want to sit back and relax and listen.
Yeah, it's got this simultaneous intensity and soulfulness that brings a load of meaning to the moment, but also this just groove, this grooviness, this trance-like grooviness that makes you just ease into it, like you said. I think that's really the thing. I think when I was hearing the banjo and Doc singing, what I was really struck by was that this was such an American sound. It was, and I'd been studying in China for years, and it was my major, and I was just totally in Chinese culture. And so when I heard this thing that was so very different and so very American, is all I can say, I was really struck by it. And when I say American, I mean this early old time sound that's connected to the old Scottish fiddle tunes, the Irish ballads, mixed with the sounds that came from Africa, with the playing of these instruments in this very trance-like way from West Africa, like the Nkanting from Gambia, the Ngoni from Mali, these kinds of instruments that ended up on the east coast of America and started mingling with the other new immigrants, including the Scottish and the Irish. It's just a powerful mix, and you hear it all right there in Doc's playing Shady Grove.
Yeah, it's beautiful. The banjo encompasses all that history, all those cultures. Bela, I'm looking at Bela Anton Leos Fleck. Were you hearing some of those sounds of Webern, Bartok, Janacek growing up?
Well, honestly, I wasn't hearing that music when I was a kid. My mother and my father split up when I was very young, and he was the one that was really interested in all of that crazy Hungarian and Eastern European music, classical music. And in fact, I didn't meet him until I was in my 40s, so he was no influence whatsoever, except the names. But then again, there's that song, A Boy Named Sue, that Johnny Cash sings about the father naming a boy Sue so he learns how to fight. So maybe there's some influence after all.
Did you have an eclectic group of music to listen to from a boy, or was it, did that come to you later in life as well?
I had a very eclectic musical upbringing, and it was just growing up in New York City, me and my older brother Louis. Listened to everything that was happening. This is the 60s when we were kids, and the Beatles were our heroes, and then, you know, musicians became our heroes basically from then on. Those were our heroes, and it was a great time for music and for expanding the idea of what could be done with music, because everybody stretched. Like, nobody stayed the same. The artists that became successful in the 60s were like, you know, thinking about Miles Davis, his music, of course, he was way successful before the 60s, but he was pushing to the outside edge. The Beatles just kept changing album after album. And then the folk movement, people like Joni Mitchell, who had started folky and changed and grew into more and more different directions. It just seemed like that's what you're supposed to do. So when I fell for the banjo, also a North Carolina boy named Earl Scruggs, who I had a very similar reaction to Abby, although it was more based in the sound of the banjo itself. It just changed me, and I just loved that sound from that moment on. And it wasn't until I was 15 I got my first banjo, so I was learning to play it in New York City in the 60s. Well, I guess this would be the early 70s by the time I got my first banjo. But I'd already been, you know, I didn't grow up on a cabin home on a hill. I grew up on a city street in uptown New York City, so I just had a whole different set of influences. But that love of the banjo and that soulful quality that it has was... the center of what I really cared about.
That makes so much sense to me. I think of well, Joni and Mingus and Miles with Bitches Brew around that time, and I guess a little bit later. And as far as a model of experimentation and something that comes back again and again in your music, just pursuing different styles, different sounds, different textures in neat ways.
Yeah, I think most people that grew up in the 60s and were impacted by the Beatles feel like they're supposed to keep changing and learning and finding new ways to express themselves. Because those guys changed so much in their short time together as the Beatles. It's astonishing that it's even the same band. But my favorite musicians all do that. I mean, people like Miles Davis, people like Chick Corea, Pat Metheny, you know, even my banjo teacher, Tony Trischka, even Earl Scruggs, you know, was constantly looking for new settings to put himself in. Although he pretty much tended to play the Scruggs style, he was very open to playing in different settings.
Yeah.
And Bale has been a real mentor to me in that sense, too. I was new to music in general, playing instruments as well as the business of music. And Bela has taught me a lot over the years about longevity and the evolution of the artistic soul inside of a person. And I've been really moved by that, and it's guided my trajectory in a pretty major way, seeing that influence in Bela's work as well as the people he loves.
Is that sort of growth beyond invigorating? Are there moments where you just like to slow things down, or is it all good? How do you assess that, embracing it all?
For me, there are times when it suddenly occurs to me that I spend most of my life not knowing what I'm doing and trying to figure out how to make something work. And because most of the music I play, the banjo hasn't been in before, and because it hasn't, I don't have the training in it. And so I have to sort of do on-the-job training with some of the best musicians in the world. And it is intimidating, and there are times when I actually get to play bluegrass again with my friends like Sam Bush and Jerry Douglas and Brian Sutton, Stuart Duncan, or the McCurry guys, or Danny Paisley. And I realize I know how to do that. I know what the banjo is supposed to do in bluegrass. I know what every musician of note from the beginning all the way up until my time, how they would play any given song. Well, you know, what are the options? What are the sonic possibilities? How do you back things up properly? And I know how I want to do it based on all of that study of all those different people and just being around it from the beginning of my musical, you know, from my playing. But when I'm doing my own music, I often have no idea how I'm going to make it work. And so sometimes it's exhausting, and then I realize, oh, well, you know, you're doing something that, you know, you don't know how to do. I'm getting pretty good at figuring out how to do it, but it is awfully nice to play some music where you know exactly what the banjo is supposed to do. And in fact, I feel that way when I play with Abby, to bring it to the two of us a little bit. I feel completely at ease in a way that I don't often feel in all the other settings that I do, which there's always a sense of like, I'm holding it together. I got to make this work. And by the end of a tour, it gets more and more natural. Like I just did a whole tour with a string quartet called Brooklyn Rider. And in the beginning that was tough, but boy, it's sailing now. But that feeling of freedom that I get at the end of a trip like that, I have that from the beginning with Abby. I've had that with her from the very beginning. The two banjos together, the kind of rhythm she plays, the kind of songs that she sings, gives me a whole different feeling. And because of that, I think I'm also much more comfortable sharing myself with an audience, like talking, which I never do in almost any other setting that I'm in, talk to the audience in any kind of meaningful way. I'm usually very shy. But with Abby, we just rap. We goof around the whole time, and it's a whole different thing.
Well, I got to say, Abigail, you are. I'm a big fan of TED Talk, and I've watched many. And you express yourself with such poise, and the pauses are so perfectly laid out. I was really impressed just along those lines. Not to mention the content of your talk. I'm wondering, in terms of that performing with your spouse, I'm curious to know the level of communication that closeness gives you, and if it's ever tough, and what's it like?
Well, there's two things that you mentioned. One is I learned a lot from the TED Talks, and that I was a TED Fellow. I applied to be able to go to the conference for free, essentially. And in order to do that, you have to become a TED Fellow, and they pick 25 people to do that every year or something around that number. And I was so excited to be picked. And then what I didn't realize was if you're picked, you have to do a TED Fellow talk, which is, you know, in that same huge auditorium. Well, it's not the same huge auditorium, but anyway, it's in a huge auditorium in Long Beach, California, where the TED Talks used to be, and the main ones. And I knew that I was going to have 6 minutes. Well, actually, they said 4.5 minutes, and mine ended up being 6 minutes. But I knew I had 4.5 minutes to say something meaningful. I mean, it was, you know, you stand on that little red dot in the middle of the stage and in front of a lot of people, influential, thoughtful people, and I had 4.5 minutes to say something, and that was a really hard canvas to fill. I worked really, really hard on it, and I knew it was a really important moment where not only for my own self-understanding, but definitely for who I was going to be in the world, who I want to be. And that was an intense process, figuring that out. Bela was really helpful. My brother was really helpful. And Ann Patchett, a great writer, was incredibly helpful to me. And I ended up realizing that I could say 16 sentences, and I had to deliver them in a way that made it like a song, that it felt lyrical and musical, that it had crescendos, that it climaxed, and that it left you with this new sense of possibility. And it's probably the hardest song I've ever written.
I can't believe that. Well, it was so expertly put together, and like you said, the arch of it, the cadence at the end, for me, tied it all together so beautifully when you referenced the power of music to connect hearts. And I think that's a message we need to hear more of today. Could you expand on that aspect of it just a little bit?
Oh, well, yeah. I've been going to China off and on for the last 17 years now. And when I became a musician, when I realized I wasn't going to be a lawyer in China and I was going to be a musician, that sort of fateful moment in my life, I went back to China. And instead of going to law school, I went and I visited with some friends and they set up some gigs for me, because suddenly here I was, this musician. And, you know, I had always had this intention to try to positively affect U.S.-China relations, because in my studies I realized pretty quickly that Americans and Chinese often really misunderstand each other. And our psychology is so different that when we try to talk to one another, when there actually is a shared common linguistic, you know, actual language, it can be really hard to understand each other, even if the words are coming out. So when I started playing music, I realized all of those obstacles, all the obstacles of language, misunderstanding, all the obstacles that intelligence bring to communication disappear. It's like all of a sudden there's an openness and an empathy, and I'd even say an optimism to the moment when people from different cultures, and I've seen it certainly with Chinese and American musicians, when they sit down and play together and realize they can make a beautiful sound, it just becomes real apparent to me that peace is possible and that harmony isn't that far off, and music is the key.
And I'm just going to pile in here. I've had the same experience too, and I learned it first on U.S. State Department tours with Newgrass Revival back in the 80s. We went to India and Bangladesh and Egypt and all these different places. And I would always try to find musicians. And I discovered that when I jammed with the local musicians, everybody, the room would just fill with joy. Once we started to play together, everything would change. And they would start out maybe, you know, not sure they wanted to be there, suspicious why we were even doing this. And then it would just bring all of this joy. And it's kind of what that experience led me when I went to the Pacific Rim with the Flecktones on one of those trips. Every show we did, we would find a local musician and bring them up on stage and learn a song and play a local song. And it broke down the walls like nothing I've ever seen. The audiences flipped out it, that we would take the effort to learn their song and play it with the local musician, which is also what led me to know that going to Africa, the same thing would happen when I went to do the Throw Down Your Heart project. And I went to research some banjo origins, but mostly just to experience that kind of feeling with the great African musicians.
Mm. Boy, I wish there was some, and maybe there already exists, an organization that could harness both of your all's energies and your colleagues in the music world along those lines in a, you know, sustained effort. It seems like that would be money, research time well spent in terms of building those bridges.
Well, I would say that if the government is doing a negotiation with a foreign power, I think they should have a musical collaboration at each one of those events.
Yeah.
That the politicians have to go attend. And the warmth will spread through all of those people, and they will try to understand each other better. I don't know if it's practical, but it seems like it would be a wonderful thing with the right musicians.
It certainly would be. I've only had a chance to hear you in concert a couple of times, Bela. One was with the Flecktones in Austin, the whole band, and then in a chamber music setting. The most recent was with Edgar Meyers and Zakir Hussain in Door County, Wisconsin, of all places. What's that dynamic like performing with those two individuals, and your takeaway from those interactions with Edgar and Zakir?
Oh, man, those are two of my favorite musical sources, favorite friends in the world. We have a very warm relationship, and I think part of it is based on the fact that the three of us do very different things. and bring very different things. But Edgar has been a combination of a peer and a hero or a source for me ever since I first met him in the early 80s. So we're old friends, and like I said, we're peers. He's a little bit younger than me, so I'm not quite as intimidated by him as I should be. But Zach here is a little bit different, being someone I've listened to since the 70s, also been a hero, and he's just such a kind, warm person and a sharing person that that kind of intimidation evaporates pretty quickly if he decides he likes you, I guess. And the three of us got along very, very well, and we all learned tremendous things from each other, mostly me and Edgar from Zakir, but me continuing from Edgar.
Mm. Yeah, from the audience perspective, I learned a whole bunch in that, and I thank you all three for that performance.
Thank you. We're going to bring that back. That's a dormant project, just like the Flecktones right now, but they're both far from dead. They're just in hibernation until they're ready to come back out.
Great. Well, it's so nice that you both can involve yourselves in a number of different projects and learn and grow through all those. And this one coming up, the two of you performing in Winston-Salem is going to be just awesome. I'm really looking forward to listeners having a chance to be in that relatively intimate stage here at Sika. I was really struck by the full sound that you both get with just two banjos. I mean, some orchestral textures, some really full things, and then the intimate sounds. Well, first off, is it fun to arrange for those two instruments? And then, just practically speaking, how do you manage not to step on each other's toes there? It really, the two instruments just pair up so nicely.
Well, luckily, we both bring such different ways of approaching the banjo and ways of thinking about music in general that I think it just ends up being a really lovely combination. There haven't been that many examples that I know of throughout the music that I've heard recorded where you hear clawhammer banjo and three-finger picking played together in a real comprehensive, extended way. And so Bela and I, in some ways, are forging new ground. I know it's happened a lot over throughout history, but how to record it and make it something that's just is exciting to actually listen to for a whole night and then for a whole record, those are the kinds of challenges we're looking at. But in general, I'd say the way that the clawhammer rolls is a really different roll from the way the Bela's three-finger style. Although I say Bela's three-finger style, but if anybody knows Bela's playing at all, they know that he can do so many different things with that three-finger style, and it'll take you a lot of different places. So I'm sort of more of the cornerstone that just kind of keeps my groove going in my old-time way, and Bela creates these incredible flourishes and feelings throughout the music that connect to the heart of the song that is just really spectacular.
It's the whole spectrum. It's a beautiful combination. The interjection of harmonics I was listening to on New South Africa Post and some of your tunes at Tennessee State Museum in Nashville. I think listeners are going to really freak out. I was not expecting such variety. I should have been, but it's a beautiful combination of sound.
Well, that's the fun of it, is trying to figure out how to make it complete and varied. And one of the things we've been using is banjos of unusual sizes, to quote The Princess Bride. But we have the cello banjo, and we have the baritone banjo, which I've been helping create a new baritone banjo. So that Abby is generally the fundamental. She is usually holding the groove, and then I'm either below or above, or alternating. But also there are times when Abby gets pushed. Now, she's also the vocalist, so she's the only person with the long notes, and she's the center of a lot of the songs that way. And so I like to think of myself as a jazz accompanist to a great vocalist. That's something that you see where you have a famous vocalist and then they bring in top people to play with them and you hear this accompaniment that is an improv. It's an improvisation by a jazz musician. And so I try to bring some of that energy to the two banjo conversation where Abby is the lead vocalist and I'm like a jazz pianist accompanying. And that gives it some different colors. And then other times we're really just grooving together. I'm playing bluegrass and she's playing clawhammer. And I do want to mention there's one other time I got to play clawhammer and bluegrass together, which was on a Doc Watson album with Merle Watson playing clawhammer. And we did several songs on that record called Riding the Midnight Train, and it worked like gangbusters. And that was one of the reasons I knew that it would work when we finally got to do our duo.
Mm-hmm. I've written that one down. I'm going to go grab that one right after I hang up the phone here. Abigail, your voice is so varied. It's so many different textures. See, earlier today, I heard you singing, I think it was in Mandarin, in this amazing belting female Chinese vocalist style.
Yeah.
wondering what part of that that came easy to you? What was more challenging, and does it you know it all influence your singing in other contexts? Just that style.
You know, that's been one of the important things to me. A really important thing is that no matter what kind of song or tradition I'm pulling my sort of song material from, where no matter where I've learned the song from, I'm trying to just stay really centered and still have it be my voice rather than trying to copy the tradition or copy the way that I heard something sung. Hmm. And that's been a big part of me discovering who I am as an artist, is discovering how to keep a very centered and a voice that is the narrator that ties everything together. So if you were to hear that song, Taiyang Chu Lai Xi Yang Yang, sung in China, in southwest China, in Yunnan or in Hunan or Sichuan, where it comes from, you'd probably hear it pretty differently. It would be like this high bell-like siren's call that's really intense, almost like a cat calling, or mixed with a nymph or something. It's just a really different sound. And yet the music I love and where I've come from when I make a loud sound when I'm singing is more of the sort of 60s, 50s and 60s gospel sound, black gospel sound that I was influenced by, Mahalia Jackson, Aretha Franklin. Those are the people I listen to. So when I bring my big sound to an old folk song, that's a lot of, you know, from China or from anywhere, that's a lot of where my robustness, a lot of that sort of vigor in my voice it comes from. So there's that connection. I'm still me singing the song. I'm not becoming some kind of Chinese folk singer to sing the song. Do you know what I mean?
I know exactly what you mean. I think you use it in the context of an example during the TED Talks to kind of grip the listeners, and you really belted it out there for a moment in a way that on your albums and other contexts, it is more, oh, this is Abigail singing with in a different language, or, you know, versus a more exaggerated, I guess, stylized reproduction. But yeah, I get you.
Mm-hmm. I've seen you do both, honestly.
Yeah.
I've seen you really go all the way into the Chinese thing and also do it. But I think when I wasn't all that open to Chinese music till I heard you doing it, and I liked the sound of your, I loved your voice already, and then hearing you do that kind of music opened up Chinese music to me, and then after that I started to really enjoy it. Mm. So I think somebody like Abby can be a real bridge for people that maybe weren't open to that before.
During your concertizing through China, Abigail, did you hear... When I hear that music, particularly, say, I'm hearing a Chinese or Japanese banjo-like instrument, like the is it shamisen?
Yeah.
Perform. I think I hear Appalachian folk-like types of sounds within them. Did you draw any connections along those lines during your tours through China? Any interesting responses along those ways?
Oh, yeah. There's so many instruments that are like the banjo around the world, and I think it has to do with the fact that creating instruments to accompany voice has been an essential part of human expression since the beginning of time. I mean, you find so many instruments around the world that essentially started as these found natural objects, like a piece of bamboo stuck into a gourd with a hide head and gut strings, and many, many different playing styles around the world that go with those basic elements that create what seems to be a banjo-like instrument everywhere in the world. So when I've traveled through China and I hear this, what they call one of them there is the shanxiar, or people think the pipa is another one that sounds really similar to the American banjo. There's a kindred connection there immediately. And I've been really drawn in particular to the shanxiar and the pipa players and the zhongren players that are just essentially these banjo-like lute instruments that are played with in a roll-like manner.
But oddly enough, the pipa is a wooden instrument. There's no skin head on it at all, but it's played with fingers like a banjo, except the fingers go in both directions, where the banjo picks only go in one direction. But the arhu, which sounds like a human voice or a violin, is actually, in my mind, a banjo, because it's a gourd with a skin head on it. It happens to be a snake skin, but it's played with a bow, so it doesn't sound what we expect it to sound.
And the shanxiar is a three, that literally means three strings, is a banjo-like instrument but has a snakeskin head and a wooden body and a bamboo neck and three strings, but no drone string, which is one of the really special things about the American banjo, is that there's this fifth string that's shorter and drones and syncopates.
That's the African influence.
That's the African influence. That's how we know it comes from Western Africa.
in terms of the duo coming to this neck of the woods shortly, you mentioned on the website, this is on Bela's website, you mentioned that you're going to let the duo discover its identity on this tour before heading into the recording studio. We're looking forward to the recording. Could you describe the process and what you're listening for and what you've discovered so far along those lines? You alluded to a little bit of that earlier.
Sure. Well, I think that everything we've come up with so far, and we've actually done a significant number of shows already, has been working with what already exists. You know, tunes that I have already written, tunes that Abby's already written from her repertoire, traditional material, stuff that we could just go play if somebody said, hey, can you guys do a show for us? We lost somebody at Folk Festival in Colorado. Would you guys do a duo set for us? We know you're around. And we did it and threw together a set of things we knew. That was one of the first times we played together in a real concert, but also we would do benefits, or we played at Abby's grandmother's church and just threw something together, and it worked. Like, it was, the show was one of the better shows either of us had ever gotten to do. We were like, wow, that was easy. So, but now that we're actually making a record, we want to go past that easy stage, because a lot of that stuff is material that Abby's already recorded, and, you know, we want to create new music that is specific to our duo, which means writing new music, finding material that is underdone that we feel really we can identify with and present in an interesting way. So we're in the process right now of bringing in and working through new material, and finding different combinations of banjos is a lot of fun for us too, because we have a piccolo banjo, I have a 10-string, you know, like a 12-string guitar type banjo, we have gut string banjos, we got the baritone banjo, we got the cello banjo.
Clearly, we're making it a priority to make it a banjo-only record. And we both feel pretty strongly about that, because we, in our other projects, we go into all kinds of territory with all kinds of different instruments. Bela, whole orchestras, me, you know, with the pedal steels and basses and keys and everything. So we're both eager to make this just a real concentrated banjo record. Yeah.
And just that everything is played by us. The two of us, basically live, so that, you know, we can duplicate it live in concert, and that there's no question when you listen to it that, oh, well, there's 10 people. No, it's just the two of us. It's always going to be the two of us on this particular project. Mm-hmm. And those are the limitations that make a project special, is when you make a decision like that, then it becomes a very specific record. It's not trying to be everything. It's trying to be one thing. Mm-hmm. And I've just learned that if you're lucky, you'll get to make a lot of records, and you should let each one be itself. Mm-hmm. And so I guess that's what we're trying to do with our whole duo, is let it find its natural place.
Yeah, you're definitely catching us at a moment where we're trying to figure out how to push it a little further. And just last night we were sitting there listening to what we already had and thinking about it and going, oh, you know what? We really need to create some new material and collaborate in a way that inspires us beyond what we already know to do, what we already can do. So I guess that's part of the identity we're going to be discovering on this next tour, is trying to collaborate in a way that creates really new material.
Hmm, that's great. Is it Stravinsky who said something about with the more restraints I have, the freer I become?
I don't know, but I think it's true. I think it, because the world is a possibility if there's no limitations, and the truth is actually putting up some walls makes where to be creative much more obvious.
Yeah. Well, we are so looking forward to having you both here, and I really appreciate you taking time out of your, I'm sure, zany schedules now to chat with me. And thank you so much for your dedication to what you both do. I'm a huge fan, and look forward to hearing you when you come to Winston-Salem.
Thank you.
David, thank you so much, and thanks for taking the time to bring us into the fold there.
My pleasure.